ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Yumi Steins here, host of the hit podcast, Ladies, We Need to Talk. October is Mental Health Month, and to get behind it, we're taking a look at some of the most common mental health disorders facing women, depression and anxiety, and how we can treat them.
I love anxiety. I think it's the mental health condition that has the best outcome.
You can binge Ladies We Need to Talk on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dr. Emma Shortis, welcome to Not Stupid. You're filling in for Jules this week.
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Now, I've never told you this, but you've been one of my silent study companions because you're a historian, an expert on US politics, highly trusted. And this is a big week for Donald Trump, one of the big tours of his presidency. Mm-hmm. And he's heading to a meeting with Xi Jinping. Imagine being a fly on the wall for that.
Imagine, Des. I think there's a lot of members of Trump's own cabinet who would like to be a fly on the wall at that meeting because who knows what's going to happen.
I'm Jeremy Fernandez in Sydney on Gadigal land.
And I'm Emma Shortis. I'm Director of International and Security Affairs at the Australia Institute.
And this is Not Stupid, where we chat about the news of the week, the stuff that's tickling your feeds, a few fun things as well, Emma. But I want to start with Donald Trump. This could be one of the most consequential trips of his presidency. He's been to ASEAN, where local leaders rolled out the red carpet. He's been to Japan to meet the new conservative prime minister, Sanae Takeuchi. He signed a critical minerals deal there. So successful, I guess, for the US administration up to this point. But the big daddy of the meetings, though, is the one with Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. Tell us why this is so significant.
Well, of course, the United States and China have had a pretty rocky relationship over the last decade or so, and Trump hasn't met Xi since his last administration, since Trump 1.0. And since Trump returned to office, tensions have been very high. So there's been bans on exports of critical minerals to the United States, which has had a big impact on the US economy, and then, you know, reciprocal tariffs and a kind of ratcheting up of rhetoric. So this is all about Donald Trump getting there and fixing everything and stitching up a deal.
But the fixing of the issue was one of his creating, right? Because the tit-for-tat tariffs came about as a result of, you know, the US introduced tariffs, China responded, the US responded, China responded. And so all this has happened under his so far short second term.
It sure has.
How does he fix that problem, given that a lot of these ideas, these tensions, were created by his response to China in the first place?
Well, I think, Jez, he doesn't fix the problem. That's not what Donald Trump does. I think you identified it correctly. He creates problems and then he makes a show of making a deal to apparently fix them. But usually what happens is he'll make a big announcement, there'll be a big fanfare, you know, about a ceasefire or a deal, and then later it'll turn out that actually the details are a little bit vague, but, you know, the news cycle's moved on, Trump's moved on to the next thing. So he's very clever like that at manipulating how we see him as a deal maker.
So who goes in with the upper hand here? Because the Chinese know this, right?
They do.
So who goes in with the upper hand about giving the other some leeway, what they need to appear successful, even if what materializes isn't that useful or much of a much progress?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, I mean, Donald Trump always thinks he's going in with the upper hand, doesn't he? You know, he always thinks he's coming from a position of strength. But I think you're right at what you're getting at there, Jez. You know, the Chinese understand Trump. They understand what they're dealing with. And I think they do hold the cards in this situation. You know, Trump is going to them because of this ban on critical minerals, which can have a huge and is having a huge effect on US manufacturing capacity. And I think the Chinese leader also knows that Trump's tariffs are actually, as our own prime minister has described them, an act of self-harm. Like, they're having a bigger impact on American consumers, I think, than they are on the Chinese economy. So Trump goes in, I think, you know, with that power play. And he's also, Trump's also been like forward sizzling that he's got a deal, that a deal is all stitched up. And so if he doesn't get a deal, he's going to look pretty silly. So I think in that sense, you know, Xi has the power, but he's also smart enough to understand Donald Trump and to know that Trump is going to want to look like he's won. He's going to want to be able to stand up and say, he got the deal, I'm the deal maker. And I think that they'll largely let him do that. What do you think?
I don't know what to make of it. The idea that Donald Trump is going in to fix a problem that was of his own making, I'm sure the Chinese obviously have worked that out. Yep. But he's also kind of struck this critical minerals deal with Australia. Mm-hmm. He's struck a similar deal with Japan.
And Malaysia.
And Malaysia. So, you know, it's been a successful tour. He's had a successful time in meeting with Anthony Albanese to try to mitigate some of that Chinese influence, the Chinese dominance of critical minerals. But why is that so important to the American economy? If we take this America first kind of mantra, right, why does going to China and striking a deal with China, how does that put America first?
Well, I think this is where the details of those critical mineral deals are really important, Jez, because you're right that he struck a deal with Australia, but there's really long lead times here with actually like digging this stuff out of the ground and processing it and getting it to the United States.
And these critical minerals are largely for technology, right?
Yeah, that's right. So things like car manufacturing, like the mechanism that opens your boot, they're also really important for military manufacturing, for weapons guidance systems and things like that. So they play a huge role in high-tech manufacturing kind of across the board. And are essential in that sense to the US economy. And immediate supplies are needed to maintain that manufacturing capacity. And so, you know, Trump can strike a deal with Australia, but that's all got to be worked out. They've got to find $5 billion in private investment before the deal kind of goes ahead. And so in that sense, Trump needs to strike a deal to fix that gap, I think, in supply. And that's where he needs China. So he can make all of those other deals, but he needs China immediately. And I think it's also important to say that those deals with Japan and Malaysia are really just kind of promises to help each other out when it comes to the supply of critical minerals. They won't
necessarily
change.
And to send them to America first. There's a priority treatment that comes with those deals.
That's generally the idea. But if we take the Malaysia deal as an example, really all the Malaysians have done is promise not to block the supply of critical minerals. So they haven't necessarily agreed to even increase supply. They've just said, oh, we won't block it. We won't put export controls on it like the Chinese have done. So that's what I mean about, you know, Donald Trump talks about these deals, but then you kind of scratch the surface of them and realize there's not necessarily a lot of substance or a lot of immediate impact.
Now, tariffs are not the only thing on the agenda. Taiwan is back as an issue that we expect to be discussed during this meeting. Donald Trump has previously been asked about whether he thinks China was about to invade Taiwan. He doesn't think that's going to happen, which is kind of contrary to some of the other rhetoric we've seen around Taiwan and China's intentions. How do you see that playing out and his willingness to be part of a discussion, a negotiation, not just about Taiwan, but about Russia and Ukraine as well?
Yeah, sure. So I think we are, especially in Australia, we're used to hearing this idea that, you know, China is likely to invade Taiwan any day now. This could happen immediately. And we've been hearing that for years. And the same is true in the States. You know, if we go back to the Biden administration, Biden kind of spoke in that way and was a bit too explicit about what the United States would do in that case. And Trump approaches the issue, at least at the moment, Trump approaches the issue very differently. So on the 20th of October, actually, when he met Anthony Albanese, he said that Taiwan was really only one of the four top priorities that he had with China alongside tariffs and soybeans, for example. And he said, we'll get along very well with China. So he's minimizing, I think, the idea that this is a conflict. And he also does that typical Trumpy thing and says, you know, we've got the biggest military in the world. No one's gonna mess with us. But that, I think we've got to be really careful, Jez, because so often, you know, Trump will say something and we take it as given, you know, that those comments about Taiwan that he made, immediately people are like, oh, well, Trump doesn't care about Taiwan. He's changed US policy completely. I mean, sure, he has, but maybe only for today or maybe only for this week. And there's this, like, in the Trump administration, there's a kind of ideological tug of war going on over China where some of his appointees see China and its approach to Taiwan in particular as an existential threat to American power that has to be countered no matter what. And then there's another side that is much more pragmatic when it comes to China and takes the kind of Trumpian view that these strongmen have their spheres of influence. So China has a sphere of influence, Vladimir Putin in Russia and Eastern Europe has a sphere of influence. And
but those
United
spheres
States
overlap,
has
right?
They
Russia
do,
Russia and China,
right?
Particularly, I'm thinking of here.
Yeah, and that's where it gets complicated. But, you know, Donald Trump doesn't see the world in particularly complicated terms. He sees it in, you know, transactional power relations. And that's how I think he's approaching Taiwan. And that's certainly sending a lot of people in the US and Australia scrambling to understand what that's going to mean.
Where does it leave Australia? Because these are two key trading partners, you know, trade and defence particularly. Yeah. Where does that leave us in trying to navigate a friendly relationship with both?
It's not easy, hey, especially when stuff changes, you know, so quickly, when Trump's saying one thing one day and something else the next. Look, I think it's entirely possible, Jez, to navigate through that. It's not easy, but I think to its credit, the current Australian government has done a really good job of managing a complex relationship with China. I think sometimes that's made more difficult by a closer relationship with the United States, and particularly our defence relationship, you know, when we're so focused on that AUKUS submarine deal. But I think, you know, the biggest thing for Australia is to not assume that our interests are the same as America's when it comes to China. You know, sometimes I think we think we've got the same interests and the same things at stake.
Sort of a Western ideology.
Yeah, exactly. But we have a very different relationship with China than the United States, a very different economic relationship for one thing. So, yeah, navigating that is tricky, but it's certainly possible. Do you think, you know, Australia can manage to get that right?
I don't know. I'm just glad it's not my job.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Now, Emma, I've got a bit of a confession. I've been going down a Zohran Mamdani rabbit hole lately. So for those who are not familiar, Zohran Mamdani is the Democratic candidate for the New York City mayoral election. He's running to represent the five boroughs of New York City. I don't know if I've ever been this interested in a local government election ever in my life. And it's not so much about local government in the US, but what it represents for American politics and how consequential it is for the Democratic Party and the shape of the global order right now, right? So Zohran Mamdani is a 34-year-old millennial, the son of an Indian Ugandan father who's an academic and an Indian American mother. He's Muslim. He's a former rapper, pretty B-grade rapper, if you ask me.
No, it's not good.
But still a rapper. He's a self-described democratic socialist. He would become the first millennial mayor of New York City. And Noah Yachot, writing for The Guardian, says he's on track to become the United States' most prominent Palestine supporter to have assumed elected office in the most Jewish city outside Israel, New York City. And in July, there was this poll that found that 43% of Jewish New Yorkers were planning on supporting Mamdani, including 67% of Jewish New Yorkers who are under 44 years old. Mm-hmm. So the younger they get, the more progressive and more pro-Palestine and more Mamdani they are, even if they are Jewish. Now, the Jewish vote is roughly 15% of the voting electorate in New York City, so it's not huge. He doesn't need that electorate to win this because he's so far and ahead, favoured to win this electoral race. But this is the first time that Israel and Gaza and the Israeli leadership is part of the mainstream debate of US politics. And I find it fascinating that Mamdani, you know, when you look at his profile, he stands for the absolute opposite of what American politics is right now. You must have been watching this as well and going, what's going on here?
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating. And it is kind of funny to be so invested in a race for local government, you know, so far away. But I think it's because you're right, Jez, it sort of embodies the battle for the soul of the Democratic Party that's been going on for so long. And it also shows, you know, in what you're outlining there about the Jewish vote in particular, just how much the landscape is changing around electoral politics, particularly with regard to Israel in the United States. And I think it's also showing up, you know, how much the established leadership of the Democratic Party has failed to recognize that and has got itself in this situation, and I mean American politics more broadly, where it's conflating Jewishness with support of Israel, and that the shift in those voting patterns shows that that's just not the case. And so many Jewish people in the United States and across the world are deeply, deeply angry and upset and grieving at Israel's actions in Palestine, and particularly American support for those actions for the right-wing Netanyahu government. And Mamdani, I think, has captured that in a way that no one else in the Democratic Party has been able to do.
What do you think about that argument, which has been made by a number of people, including Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove of the conservative Upper East Side Park Avenue Synagogue, who basically said that this election is about expressing your love for Israel, about Israel's right to exist, its identity, and to vote for Mamdani would be to vote against that. What do you think of that argument, conflating anti-Semitism with being anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, sort of anti-New York in some ways?
I think it's a really dangerous argument, Jez, and I think it's clearly falling flat with Jewish voters in New York, you know, to accuse them of anti-Semitism when what they are concerned about is unnecessary death and destruction that they've been watching unfold on their telephones.
That Jewish people in New York City have, the more progressive ones, have actually been campaigning for an end to this war, right?
Yeah, exactly. And coming at that from a particularly religious perspective and one of compassion that's not at all anti-Israel. It's anti, I think, Netanyahu and the Netanyahu government's actions. And I think suggesting or lumping everybody in who opposes those actions as anti-Semites or as Trump's press secretary has done, to say anyone protesting Trump is, you know, a Hamas supporter, risks driving people away. And I think it really risks the long-term security of Israel as people devastated by what is happening turn their backs, I think, on what they see as the current iteration of the Israeli government.
So this is a really big issue international affairs-wise, right? But the primary campaign for Mamdani has actually, and this is how he describes it, he said they wanted to build a campaign from the ground up. Mm-hmm. So instead of standing as a candidate and saying to the electorate, this is what I stand for, he went out to the electorate and said, what do you want me to campaign on? And this is what they came back with. Cost of living, cost of living, cost of living, cost of living. Right? So his primary campaign is actually about the cost of living in New York, about spaces to exist, homes for essential workers, the affordability of just being in New York. So among his main policies, free buses, rent controls, tax increases on the wealthy to help pay for some of these democratic socialist policies. And also on that note about Israel, he said that if Benjamin Netanyahu were to set foot in New York City, he would help facilitate his arrest in keeping with the international arrest warrant, right? Yep. So it's really interesting too that a campaign that is, you know, being watched right around the world is actually just about local issues, is what he's getting up on, about local cost of living issues. And I find that fascinating. There was a debate clip from some months ago of all the candidates lined up, and they were asked where would they first make their first visit when they become mayor. Mm-hmm. Every one of them said, visit the Holy Land, visit Israel, visit Israel, visit Israel. Do you know what his answer was? I would stay in New York and visit the five boroughs of New York City because I'm running to be the mayor of New York. I'm not running for, you know, some sort of foreign role. Mm-hmm. I'm running to be the mayor of New York. It was such a clever answer.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your take about whether this is all just very slick marketing and big promises, or whether there is a lesson here for the Democrats about how to connect with people on basic issues like cost of living in order to rediscover, as you say, the soul of the Democratic Party.
I mean, I think that kind of remains to be seen, Jez, doesn't it? Because we don't know what the result of the election is. But certainly my read of it at the moment is that Mamdani is doing the work. Like, he is, as you say, pounding the pavement. Like, so much of his social media content is him walking the streets of New York, engaging with voters and bringing people along that you wouldn't expect to vote for the Democrats, or who the Democrats have lost under the leadership of somebody like Andrew Cuomo, the former mayor, who's, you know, a little bit problematic.
Yeah, so he's had allegations of sexual assault made against him in the past. He left office as a result of that. He's been accused of hiding the COVID death numbers when he was mayor of New York. He's now running as an independent because Mamdani trumped him for the candidacy, right? Yep. So they've got a famously fiery rivalry between them, and Cuomo has described Mamdani as a terrorist supporter for his support of Palestine. How do you think that's all going to play out? Like, which issue wins? The Jewish identity of Israel kind of being as a sort of a dominant feature of the city's character, or those basic cost of living issues?
I don't think that we necessarily have to choose between the two. Like, I think particularly when, you know, you mentioned younger voters before, Jez, I think those two issues are both motivating factors, and Mamdani is speaking to both of them. You know, the cost of living crisis that Trump is utterly failing to address and in fact is making significantly worse, is having a huge impact on Americans and New Yorkers in particular. Like, New York is an insanely expensive place to live. But it's also true that, you know, Democratic voters in particular are motivated by the issue of Israel and have been for a really long time. And they've been trying so hard to tell the leadership of the Democratic Party that. So I keep going back, Jez, to the before the last presidential election, during the primary process, where Joe Biden, you know, he was a shoo-in for winning the nomination. But in Michigan, which is a key swing state for Democrats, 100,000 Democratic voters came out in the primaries and voted for no one over Joe Biden as a protest for Biden's support for the Israeli government.
Right.
So that was a pretty clear message.
Yeah, in like a read the room kind of moment,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. And the Democrats didn't listen to that. They didn't hear that. And they lost Michigan in the end, you know, by less than 100,000 votes. So I think, you know, that message just hasn't been getting through to the leadership. And that's why you find Mamdani and figures like him drawing so much support, particularly from a younger, diverse base of the Democratic Party. And again, you know, that's part of this bigger ideological battle that's going on in a party that's just tearing itself apart over issues like this.
Hakeem Jeffries, who's the Democrats' House Minority Leader in the States, has recently endorsed Mamdani. And the Republicans are seizing on that, right, and characterising Mamdani as this socialist who's, you know, kind of basically going to take over the Democratic Party and then take over all of America. This is the danger. What does this mean for the midterms, and how effective is that message going to be?
Yeah, so the midterms are like an eternity away, Jez, in Trump time. You know, imagine what can happen between now and November next year. Look, I think in, you know, in like normal political circumstances, we would say that Trump he's underwater in terms of his popularity on issue after issue. You know, he's absolutely tanking. And so you would expect that Democrats would win back the House at the midterm elections. But there's a couple of things going on there. You know, we've just been talking about how the Democrats can't get their act together. You know, they can't offer a cohesive message. They're tearing themselves apart over issues. And, you know, then, like, the second question is, this is Donald Trump's America. Like, can we assume that the midterms are going to go ahead as they normally would?
But that's the difference with the system here, right? Because in Australia, we have an opposition leader who's almost like a figurehead for the movement. And, you know, Susan Lee's the leader of the opposition here. She leads a fractured party at the moment, but she is still a figurehead. They don't have that system in the US.
No, they don't even really have political parties in the way that we would think of them, Jez. Like, the party kind of comes together every 4 years to choose a presidential candidate. But beyond that, you know, they're really, like, ideologically so diverse, and they're not bound by unity the way that our parties are. They do, you know, we describe it as crossing the floor, but they do that all the time. Like, Democrats can vote however they want in Congress. So they don't have that unity and cohesion, which means they don't have someone they can, like, rally around. And, you know, that I think can be seen as a negative, because they're not unified, they can't mobilise people around a single figure. But it can also mean that, you know, wild cards can pop out. Mamdani can emerge, you know, a young Barack Obama can emerge from Chicago and kind of take the Democratic Party in different directions. But I guess, you know, I think the thing about American politics, like, and you would have seen this all the time as well, Jez, is we're always looking for somebody to come and save them. We're looking for, like, a Barack Obama to magically kind of unite everyone and fix the party and be a kind of American superhero, right? But that's just not how politics works. Like, when the Democratic Party has managed to reinvent itself and kind of come out of crisis, it's been out of grassroots movements and really diverse coalitions, like the civil rights movement, for example. And it's come out of that really hard work of mobilizing people that's not particularly glamorous, but is really necessary to political success.
Okay, Emma, it's time for Pick of the Week, which is the time each week where we bring a surprise in for our co-host, a story that tickled our fancy. So
You've brought something in for me. Tell me, what is your pick of the week?
So my pick of the week, Jez, is Chapel Roan.
Oh, I love.
What a legend. Partly because my five-year-old is completely obsessed with her.
Good taste. Such I'm impressed.
It's such good taste. And there's just nothing better than a five-year-old in a bubble bath living her best life, just like belting out Pink Pony Club. So inappropriate. But she's actually my pick of the week because she started a charity specifically designed to support trans youth who are struggling in today's United States. And she's been on tour for the last couple of months and has raised $400,000.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing, particularly for struggling trans youth. And it's being all of that money is being donated directly to organizations who work on the ground. So I just think, you know, American politics is so awful so often. It's so grim. And to see someone being so generous and being such a wonderful ally and, you know, bringing my five-year-old so much joy is really something to hold on to.
Are you a fan?
I'm a huge fan. I cannot wait.
So am I.
To Australia.
There's lots of Chapel Road on my gym playlist, actually.
Such a good workout list.
Good on her, though.
Yeah, I think, what a legend. What a princess. What about you, Jez? What's your pick of the week?
Okay, so you heard about the big heist at the Louvre Museum in Paris. $155 million worth of jewels, actually priceless because of it's the sum of the parts, mm-hmm. right? These are historical artifacts. 4 minutes in broad daylight, four people dressed as workers in high-vis vests just used a ladder and a furniture lift, smashed a window, went in, did a smash and grab, and ran away. They dropped one crown, which was studded with emeralds and diamonds. Two men have now been arrested, one of them apparently on his way to Algeria. But it struck me when I was reading the news this week, there was a particular guy who was hanging around the outside of the window because this window has now become the latest tourist attraction. In Paris, people are going to the window where the heist happened. And there was this guy who popped up on my news, some random tourist, who said, oh, I just thought I'd come and see the window and see if they left any diamonds on the ground. Can you imagine just rummaging around on the ground, seeing what you could find, change your life, find a few jewels here and there? But I was interested in the history of those jewels. And I have to say, there's not a lot of analysis of where the jewels came from. So there's a lot of talk about their significance to French history, which royals they belong to, how they're cast, how they're set. And we're talking about thousands of gemstones, right? Yeah. But I did come across this one article in an online magazine, an arts magazine called Hyperallergic. It's based in Brooklyn in New York City. And the title of the article is, "The Louvre Heist Was a Colonial Wake-Up Call. How Austerity, Neglect and Unresolved Colonial Legacies Continue to Haunt the Museum." So the jewels, this article says, by Emmeline Smith were uninsured. And there was this whole idea that Western institutions are best placed to be the stewards of great historical artifacts and incredible pieces of artistry. But she does point out, Emmeline Smith, that fueled by slavery, French colonial outposts and broader European networks funneled such valuable resources, these stones, to royal courts and elite collectors, where they were transformed into symbols of wealth and power. Though still celebrated as emblems of national prestige today, these objects carry with them a history of exploitation, colonization, and violence. So, you know, these pearls likely came from somewhere around the Indian Ocean. Yeah. The sapphires of Ceylon, which is what Sri Lanka is today. I found it really fascinating that, you know, I saw one of those Facebook memes, someone writing, you know, fascinating that the Louvre and British museums think theft is terrible. Because the provenance of these pieces is complicated. I'm not advocating for theft. I'm just not sure there's an answer for it, right? That these pieces have a controversial history and this is just a part of it. But it's incredible to think that they had these precious items sitting next to a window that was so vulnerable to a smash and grab.
Yeah, amazing.
And now tourists are turning out to see the window for themselves.
Just wild.
Emma, it's been terrific to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming in and filling in for Jules.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm sure we'll chat again soon because there's a lot going on in US politics.
Always.
And you'll be keeping your eye right across it. Don't forget, you can email us at notstupid@abc.net.au. Our producers are Madeline Jenner and Cinnamon Nippard. Emma, catch you again next time. Thank you.
Thanks, Jez.